I want to thank A and Dan and everybody who called in. You guys are amazing. Love your thoughts. Thank you so much. And we're going to go out with some Chicano Power by The Midnighters. Just want to say all power to the people. Que viva la raza. You know, workers of the world, unite. We all got to get together somehow. And let's do it. Have a good night.
Hello, my name is TK Kapurai and I'm an immigrant from Zimbabwe. I'm the host of The Global Cell, which airs live in the Air Room the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. I host immigrants and refugees from various global spots. I like to bring out their lived experiences so the world can know something about them. I like to bring a lot through my guests so we may have diverse experiences, cultures, foods, music, interests, and anything on the platform. We can share and learn a lot through their live instructions. Let's do this together, not only for a better platform for our community, but a better community for our platform. Again, tune in for my show, The Global Cell, live in the Air Room, the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and also available on the web at kboo.fm.
Hi, I'm Michael Van Cleek, Vice President of KBOO's Board of Directors. Are you passionate about KBOO Community Radio and its mission? Do you want to use your skills and experience to contribute to the governance of the station? Consider applying to the Board of Directors. Learn more about how to become a KBOO Director by attending a virtual information session. Virtual meetings are being held from now through June. Black, Indigenous, and people of color are especially encouraged to apply. For the schedule of information sessions, visit kboo.fm/board recruiting. Thank you for considering board service for KBOO Community Radio.
Yo, this is M1 from Dead Prez.
Hey, what's up? This is Boots from the Coup.
Nah, I mean, telling you to stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Keep it locked.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance.
What's up, folks? This is your girl Femi representing the whole Bay Area. I'm here on Hard Knock Radio.
This is SJ Miyoshiro, old school graffiti writer, and when I'm not, I'm listening to Hard Knock Radio.
It is Hard Knock Radio, Davey D, hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we want to have an in-depth conversation with a dear colleague, a scholar. Her name is Danaya Martinez. As you all know, we've been hit fast and hard with all sorts of pressing issues from this current administration. And at the top of the heat, is the issue around deportations, immigration, who gets to stay in this country, who is imprisoned or being exiled and forced to leave. We know that there's been an array of horror stories about brown folks, indigenous folks, and black folks having their visas taken, going into immigration to do a check-in and never leaving. We just saw in Massachusetts unidentified ICE agents stopping a mother and daughter and literally disappearing them. And so we get this message that we don't want anybody here illegally, and heck, as each day passes by, it seems like they don't want anybody here who's not quote-unquote American. But then we got hit with these headlines that there are white Afrikaners from South Africa who are being brought to this country. They just landed, a dozen of them, several dozen of them, because they are fearing genocide in South Africa. And so this afternoon, we want to dig into the layers around that. What is really happening? And again, I couldn't think of somebody more qualified to talk about it than Danaya Martinez, Professor Danaya Martinez. She teaches in the Africana department in a couple of universities, but she's also a frequent go-to when it comes to the issue of South Africa. You spend a lot of time there. I've seen you keynote and talk about these issues. You teach a lot about it in class. So this is your wheelhouse. You're like, yo, I'm going to need some time to break this down. So what is happening? And let me just let you know, we're going to do some follow-up because she has a whole crew of people, you know, people that have been involved with the land back movements and the whole nine. So where do we start? What was your thoughts when you heard that they were going to start bringing in white South Africans, Afrikaners, who say that they are fearing genocide in South Africa?
Well, the first thought was to laugh hilariously at that, because there's just nothing, absolutely nothing true to even the thought of that happening. So, you know, the idea that they're fleeing persecution and race-based or racism just sounds kind of funny. Now, is there racism in South Africa? Absolutely. Anti-black racism, not anti-white racism, right? What we're talking, and racism again is a power structure that, you know, has to do with laws and policies, ideologies and all that. And there's actually a lot of white supremacists in South Africa. So it was no surprise to me that Elon Musk had the nerve to do a Heil Hitler sign, because there are groups that are basically Nazi copycats in South Africa. And they've been doing that for a long time. They arm themselves, they're militias. They're even pretty much white only towns, or at least one that's kind of officially white only in South Africa. So, and then when we look at some really important statistics, we know that racism is not happening, not with Afrikaners, not with British, and not with any other white group that is there. So if I just start with—
You mean racism being directed towards them?
Right. There's no racism being really directed towards them. There's a lot of backlash from the racism of apartheid and colonization that they might have to experience, but it has nothing to do with any real policies or anything like that. Just to give a little bit, so people understand, South Africa has struggled with unemployment, all kinds of things for years. So when they talk about you know, white South Africans being unemployed, their unemployment is very low, somewhere around 7.9% among white South Africans compared to 37% black South Africans. So we're not seeing racism in that area. We're also not seeing racism in terms of serving in government. There's lots of cabinet ministers, deputy ministers, that kind of thing. also in terms of management, I got a, in the private sector, white people occupied 65.9% of top management level posts, while black people occupied only 13.8% in 2022, according to South Africa's Commission for Employment Equity. And there's lots of other things, like even unskilled labor, right? The percentage of people, of white people who are in unskilled labor is 0.9%, right? The lowest paid, the people who can't pay their rent, who can't eat more than maybe one meal a day, are the black people who are in the 82.8% of those black people are in unskilled labor. And that was in 2022. So when you're looking at indicators of racism, we're not seeing any of that.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. Professor Danae Martinez is with us this afternoon. A couple of things. I remember you asked to give a report back or a keynote at SF State, and you broke down. You had just got back from South Africa. You had been there for a number of months, and you know, and came back with a report. And one of the things that you landed on was that you felt it was a big mistake that the capitalistic structure, the business structure that was there, was still allowed to exist. And you said that it was going to, that we're going to see some change, but it wasn't going to be the systemic change as you, as people would hope, that you would now have a majority black country, which it's always been, and would still have high unemployment and a lot of the inequities that were there. The only difference is that you wouldn't have the word apartheid governing it, but it would be capitalism by default, kind of, you know, creating similar conditions. I think for a lot of people, this is hard to kind of digest because there was so much celebration with the progress that South Africa was making. There was celebration about the truth and reconciliation steps that were taken, which kind of forgave a lot of people for the atrocities. And there was a lot of celebration about South Africa being a rainbow country, a model type of country where all the races come together. So I think
turn
a
off
lot
my
of,
video.
Yeah. I think a lot of folks are like, how did this happen? You know, how can this be going on in a place that seemed to be a model? So what were we missing in in some of the headline-grabbing aspects of South Africa?
So when I was talking about that, what I was kind of getting at is that there in South Africa, there is a lot of disappointment that is actually has been happening for a long time around how the ANC handled the negotiations with the white apartheid nationalist Afrikaner government, right? And so I worked on my master's thesis on it, and I really started to dive deeper into what happened. If I can just give you a little bit of background so that we kind of understand the significance, right? Mm-hmm. Right? So of course, as most people know, people came and colonized South Africa. The Afrikaners came in 1652 and started taking the land. So land, let me just say up front, land is always the major issue when it comes to South Africa, right? They come and they start taking the land, and they get rich off of that land. Then the British come in 1806, and they too get rich off that land. How are they getting rich, you ask? Gold and diamonds, right? Now, when the British come, they start fighting with the Afrikaners and basically are like, yo, this is our stuff. And the Afrikaners are like, we've been here, this our stuff, with no real regard for black people and the people, the indigenous people who were there, right? And so let me just say, what we know is that Britain would not be what it is today without specifically, definitely all of Africa, but without specifically South African land. And a lot of that happens through the mines, which of course is in the ground, right, in that land. And then the same thing goes with Afrikaners, who pretty much kept their money with and their wealth within Africa, right? And so you have this convergence, you know, that comes down on South Africa of both white groups that end up having wars called the Boer Wars over land that's not theirs, right?
So the Boer Wars was between the Dutch or the Afrikaners,
yes,
and the British.
Yes.
Over, I don't think a lot of people know that. I think a lot of people think it's, you know, is the black folks there. So you have two colonial powers,
yes,
fighting over resources that they basically housed or stole from, yes, from the black folks that are there.
Yes. And let me just say this, the when they have these wars and the Afrikaners feel so oppressed by the British for coming and taking what they consider to be their wealth, right? They have no regard for the people. But not only that, again, I can't express enough how rich white, what we now call South Africans, got from this. These are pretty much for a lot of time some of the richest white settlers in the world because of all of the mineral wealth and the gold and diamonds that is in South Africa, right? Now, the same thing goes for farming. Black people, the Khoi and the San people, which were the Bush people, as well as the Bantu people, were already in South Africa and they were farming. And here come the Afrikaners and they start, you know, giving out, making sure that the only farmers, the only people who can really farm are white South Africans. Right. And really a small number of mostly white farmers are farming there. Right. And so so that also happens. And they appropriate land in order to create, you know, stuff that we now are benefiting from. And when I say we, I'm saying the United States. We get a lot of the agricultural supplies of those farmers. We get we get a lot of minerals from South Africa as well, to the point that some of our industries couldn't exist without those, right? So mm-hmm. we have a vested interest, and what South Africans would call white monopoly capital has a vested interest in South Africans not being able to black South Africans not being able to control the resources of South Africa. Now, so all this stuff happens with colonization. So things are already going bad. But then the Afrikaners start what is called apartheid, or commonly known as apartheid. And a lot of people think apartheid is just about segregation. Absolutely not. The main part of apartheid was taking the land, appropriating the land. And they did this through several ways. Both through violence, but also through laws. One of those laws is the 1913 Natives Land Act, which limited African land ownership to 7% of the land, and later 13%.
Wait a second. So by law, no yes. more than 7% of a majority population, right? Because
yes.
the South African blacks are the majority, like 4-1. So it's a huge, huge difference that they could only own 7% of the land.
Exactly. And let me get you, and not just own, it's own or occupy. Own or occupy. Okay? Meaning they really can't exist. Right?
Wow.
In South Africa. So what they end up doing is taking the majority of black people and putting them into what I would call basically reservations, right? They're called homelands in South Africa, and they're by tribe, right? And they basically say that black people cannot buy or occupy land except as employees of a white master, right?
Wow.
Yes, this happens.
And this is in 1913.
No, actually, that's the Land Act, right? That happens in 1913. And then later on, apartheid starts bulldozing racially mixed communities and starts making sure that all of the people in racially mixed communities are now dispersed to these homelands, right?
And so that's this is where you get whites, blacks, and coloreds, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And understand that, okay, there's whites, and then which is there's several different groups, but especially British and Afrikaners, and then there's coloreds, who are basically a mixed race population that come from Afrikaner colonizers and enslavers, basically RAPEing their enslaved Africans, and they're in the Khoi and the San and mixing with them. That's why a lot of the colored people speak Afrikaans. And then you have the black people, which are considered, you know, the Zulu, the Xhosa, the Venda, right? All these black different tribes. And they're dispersed out into these areas where it's not only do they not have land, they don't have really any good land that you can grow much on, right? This then forces them to have to find a way to get a passbook, which basically is a passport to be able to travel in their own country to go work for white people in a lot of the cities and white areas. Because though they wanted the land, they didn't want to actually do the work to build it for the most part, right? And so you actually had to have a passbook that that where a white person said, hey, you're coming to work for me here. And when they brought those people to work for them there, they then went into what is called informal settlements, which is what we now call a township. These were places where they didn't build them housing for the most part. They didn't build them any place to stay or anything that would be considered livable. They actually put them in, they had to make their own shacks from like zinc and scraps of white people's houses when they built their houses. They don't have access to latrines and to, you know, basic things that are basic for white South Africans, right? And so what ends up happening is white ownership of 87% of the land, even though they're only about 9% of the population. 87% of the land goes to 9% of the population. So really, when we think about apartheid, we need to think about it as an economic endeavor, right? If 87% of the land is white owned, that means pretty much all of the good land is white owned. That means all those mines, all those farms, all of that is now making major money for white South Africans and the British, right? Not to mention the fact that as some people who are Afrikaner workers and they're not rich, they also get, during industrialization, they also are favored. They're the ones who get the jobs. And black people, even if they have a job there, cannot unionize. They cannot join the unions. So again, they're left out of the economy. They even built railroads around areas to make sure that black people couldn't participate in the economy. So it's really, you know, yes, it was segregation, but it's economic apartheid, right?
Right.
And people know that, right? It's kind of a funny story, but when I was actually going to school in South Africa, when my Afrikaner teacher was, you know, telling the story of Afrikaners and black people and the British, he starts talking about the Boer Wars and he says that they're fighting over this land. And I'm like, well, what was the black perspective? And he said they didn't have a perspective. This is in 2008, while I'm going to school at a South African university, right? And so, you know, I went home and I fought this and I found out that no, the ANC and the resistance to white domination had been around since the very beginning of colonization. And so that just wasn't true.
Right. That's kind of like saying Lincoln freed the slaves and black people should thank him in forgetting that there were 300 years of an abolitionist movement that black people started. You know, they always like to show Lloyd Garrison, the white dude, and his newspaper, and just overlook that there were all these different strategies, legal strategies, as well as resistance, you know, armed resistance to ending enslavement. And so, yeah, that kind of sleight of hand and rewriting of history is something that sadly seems to be a global phenomenon when it comes to these matters. If it's happening here, it's happening there.
Yes. And let me just say that their white supremacist movements are looking at white supremacist movements all over the world. And our white supremacist movements are looking at theirs. Dylann Roof, right? He had the flag of South Africa and Rhodesia that he was showing on his social media before he went into that church and killed all those black people. So yes, there is a global white supremacist movement that has supported South Africa being where they are, including our own presidents, including Reagan.
Right.
Right.
Ronald Reagan with his constructive engagement position. I remember that.
Yes, absolutely. So whiteness has descended upon South Africa for quite a long time. But with that, then I think it's good that I talk about the anti-apartheid movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was big here in the United States, but all over the world, really. And I would say that the anti-apartheid movement was ingenious in so many ways, right? One is that a lot of the exiles, so as apartheid starts to happen, let me start there. As apartheid starts to happen, one of the things that it does, it's eerily similar to what we're seeing today here in the United States. But, you know, as they start doing what they're doing, they're making it so that people can't even play, say, the trumpet against the white apartheid government. So people like Hugh Masekela and Miriam Makeba are basically exiled from South Africa and have to leave in order to not be tortured, killed, put in jail for the rest of their lives. And with that comes a lot of exiles, right? And so those exiles go all over the world and tell everybody about what's going on in Africa or what's going on in South Africa. But also within the country, people are fighting as well. And people are even sneaking out to different countries in the middle of the night. And I'm talking children all the way up to women and men are sneaking out in the middle of the night in order to get guerrilla warfare, you know, training in order to come back and take South Africa, the South African land back. Okay. And in that process, I just want to say, even for Black South African organizations, land is a major issue of contention. What a lot of people don't know is the ANC was never really a radical organization, right? They believed in non-racialism, meaning that, you know, South Africa's for everyone, and all they really wanted was to be able to vote and that kind of stuff, right? But and they started doing some really great things, right? They were creating the South African Freedom Charter, which they went around, the ANC sent around 50,000 volunteers into townships and the countryside to collect their freedom demands, right, from the people of South Africa. And what they wanted was to find out what Black South Africans basically wanted.
Was this during apartheid or after?
Yes, this is during apartheid in 1955. Wow.
So those type of activities,
yes,
could, you know, any sort of resistance,
yes,
you know, usually got you sent to jail and you were tortured, right?
Not just or massacred.
Yeah.
One of the things that happened was the Sharpsville massacre, where people were burning those passbooks I was talking about. They were burning them, saying we shouldn't have to have a passport in our own country. And the police came in and just massacred them with bullets for a nonviolent protest, right? So by the time that happens, there's already been this South African Freedom Charter that gets made by asking the people what they wanted. And basically what they said is they wanted land to be given to all landless peoples, right? That was point number one. Point number two, they wanted living wages and shorter hours of work. Point number three, they wanted free and compulsory education. Sounds reasonable to me when all your land has been taken and you're only, most of the time you're jobless, right? And if you do have a job, you're working at crazy hours, having to transport 2 hours to white areas in order to do work for them, right?
Right.
But out of that, they were basically saying, look, the land should be given to everyone. In terms of like, let white land, a lot of the ANC was also saying, well, maybe the white land should stay with white people, right? But the PAC, right, the Pan-African Congress, broke off of the ANC because of all their non-racialism. And their main issue was that the land should belong to Black people, the people who inhabited it from the beginning, and should be given back to them so that they can then benefit from it economically. And so that's why a whole nother group called the PAC formed. And so just about every major thing that has happened in South Africa has happened around land.
If you're just tuning in, we're getting a history lesson this afternoon, as well as a perspective on this development with Afrikaners being deemed refugees and being invited to come to the U.S., as we're seeing hundreds and thousands of people being deported and banned from this country, of people who have a darker hue. And Danaya Martinez, Professor Martinez, is giving us the backdrop, the important backdrop to understand what has been going on, what has led up to this moment, and giving us this history of South Africa and apartheid. So we appreciate this, and I'm going to yield the floor back to you, Professor.
Okay, thank you so much. So this anti-apartheid struggle is going on for a long time. In the 80s, it really comes to kind of, direct confrontation. Now you have a lot of Black South Africans that are sneaking back into the country who now have training in how to carry out guerrilla warfare, basically. And what I think was generous of the ANC government and the PAC and all these underground organizations, including, I should say, now the Black Consciousness Movement is a big thing in South Africa as well, is they come back into the country and they start targeting economic structures like railroads, like oil wells. They're not trying to kill people, even kill white people for the most part. They're basically targeting economic structures to take the white South African government down economically, because they know that's their bread and butter. And it's also coming to fruition outside of the country, where all those exiles that left before they're raising awareness has worked. And so you have places like the United States and different students in Europe and people all over the world that are demanding that white South African apartheid stops, right? And they do this through a major boycott, which I think personally is why they're outlawing the boycott of Palestine, the boycott of Israel right now, because this boycott worked so well. Right? They made them not be able to participate in the Olympics. They said that artists shouldn't go perform there. People started pulling, expecting colleges and different economic businesses to pull out of South Africa, which worked, because the white South African government was worried, right? They were like, not making any money. They weren't able to participate in anything in the world. So it really did bring them to the negotiating table, right? Along with the fear that their country, that people were coming back who knew how to use explosives and that kind of stuff. The other thing that happens is that all these civil rights organizations and anti-apartheid organizations, including unions, including like mass organizations and political parties, and the South African Communist Party come together in South Africa, and there is a thing of ungovernability, right? Mm. A tactic of ungovernability, to the point that things have to stop, right? Like, people ain't going to work, stuff is burning, right? All of that is happening at the same time. So they really surround the South African government. So that's why I say it was an ingenious plan, because they were able to really starve the South African government of the money that they needed to continue, which meant that they then went, the white South African government went to the IMF World Bank and asked for loans to be able to stop what was going on, and got them.
Okay. Wow.
That black South Africans, or I should say the South African government today, is still paying off those loans that were used to get tanks in order to kill, massacre, torture, and maim black South African people who were fighting for their freedom, right? So black people are paying for white people being able to basically bomb them and shoot them and massacre them, right? So it comes to this big, I guess you would call it an apex, where the white South African government even has white people coming to them like, you need to do something because we don't want to blow up, right? And so the white South African government goes into secret negotiations. And this is what I was talking about that day that you saw me, was going, they went into secret negotiations with different people of the ANC group. Now, mind you, they pick ANC because they are the least radical group, okay, of the black people, right? And Nelson Mandela is known all over the world because of those exiles, but also because of Winnie Mandela, right? Who is a revolutionary to the heart, right? And so they start to have these secret negotiations. So what they do is they take Nelson Mandela, they put him in a different prison away from the people who were in the ANC, other people who were in prison with him in the ANC, right? And they take Mbeki, who later becomes president, and Thabo Mbeki, who later becomes president and who is a major guy in the ANC, I guess you would say, brass, or, you know, leadership. And so they start having these secret negotiations, right? And they give Mandela a 2-bedroom house with a pool, bugged up, right? And tell him he can move his wife and kids in. And Winnie Mandela says, absolutely not. I will not move in there and have them telling me what to do, right? And so he starts getting a lot of visits from, you know, people who are represented by heads of state, because they want to make sure that Britain, the United States, and the white businessmen of South Africa are able to keep getting their money, even if they give them the power to vote, right? And so there's actually also a secret negotiation in London that happens with Thabo Mbeki. Now, I want you to guess who's at the table. Anybody, any guesses about who's at that table, that negotiation table?
Ronald Reagan?
Nope. But who is at the table, funny enough, close though, by saying Ronald Reagan, who is at the table is, of course, black South Africans with the representation of Mbeki, right? On the other side is South African white South African businessmen. And at the head of the table hosting it is a guy named Michael Young, who was from the business called Consolidated Gold Fields, gold mining.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, like, so the people that stole the minerals is the one heading the meeting.
Yes. And so, of course, they're there heading the meeting for a reason. They're not just like, I want to be a good person. No, they're heading the meeting because they want to make sure that in the process of apartheid ending, that that the British, the white South Africans keep their land, aka mines, aka wealth. Right?
Wow.
Yes. And so, and let me just say that I'm not gonna fully blame those people, black people who came to the table, right? Like Mandela and Mbeki, right? You're talking about, they've lost family members, they've lost everything. Mandela has been in jail for 25 years and he didn't go in as a young man. I think he was like 45. So dude's like 60 something, getting sick. His child has died while everything's happening. But I also will say, in the process of the anti-apartheid struggle, the people out are becoming more radical. And they're expecting that those mines, those housing developments that belong to white people, that land that belongs to white people, the farms that belong to white people are going to be returned to black people, right? And that they will. And I've had people who said to me, you know what, Danae, when I interviewed them for my thesis, they would say, I had picked out my house. I thought that we were moving into those white areas and we were going to stop being so poor. And none of us have moved into those areas. No poor people have moved into those areas or have been given the wealth that the country is sitting on. Right? South Africans, if you're to just go on the wealth of South Africa, black South Africans should be some of the richest people in the world.
Right.
Just like white South Africans have been some of the richest
people. Like Elon Musk and his family, some of the richest people in the world, but it's off the land in South Africa.
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. Right? And so, you know, Mandela, Go ahead.
I was going to ask, because you had mentioned Palestine, where did Israel sit on all this? Were they supportive of the apartheid regime, or did they try to remain neutral? Were they friends? Because sometimes they try to say, oh, no, we was rolling with Mandela, but Mandela was pretty critical of Israel for a very long time.
Oh, well, I don't know exactly where Israel landed on apartheid. I do know that a lot of Israelis, right, or if you want to call them that, a lot of people were kind of for what was going on in South Africa with apartheid because they were creating apartheid at the same time in Palestine, right? Mm-hmm. They were actually creating it. They come about, I think, one's 1948, one's 1949, something like that, or maybe even in the same year, right? Apartheid. So I'm sure they were fine with it, right? But what I do know is South Africa has always been against the apartheid of Palestinians and the killing and taking over of land of the Palestinians in
Israel. You mean the black South African?
Yes.
The people that's part of the movement. Yes.
Yes, like Mandela, ANC, all of those parties, PAC, the Black Consciousness Movement, all of those parties, the South African Communist Party was against what Israel was, or the, you know, what Israel was doing to Palestinians from the very beginning. And so it wasn't a break from the norm in South Africa for South Africa to stand up against Israel in the world court. That's the norm. And right. I think it was one thing that a lot of people in South Africa, though they are very many, a lot of them kind of upset with the ANC government, it's the one thing they were happy about that the ANC government did.
With stand up against Israel.
Yes, absolutely.
So let me come back to this. Because you had raised the question when we were talking before about who exactly are the refugees? Are these poor folks? Are these rich folks? Who are these folks that are coming over, and what's the real motivation?
Okay. Yes, I wonder who these Afrikaners are. Because if they're coming over here, let's just say rich South Africans have been coming to the United States for a long time. They come here, they live, they vacation here for thousands of dollars, right? They've been coming here. So I'm wondering who exactly are these people. Also, the farmers, no land has been really taken from them yet. So it's not like there's a whole bunch of farmers who are fleeing because their land has been taken. That hasn't really happened, right? So I do wonder who are these people. And I think who they are will tell us a lot about what's going on there. I've been trying to look into it, and I find it interesting that when they arrived here in Washington, D.C., that they were not allowed to talk to the press, right? They didn't say anything to the press, right? But you had American people who talked to the press and welcomed them and act like, you know, they're fleeing from and are refugees. They are not refugees. There was no refugee camps in South Africa. I've even been to some of the so-called poor areas where white people live, and they have actual houses with running water and all of that. Whereas Black South Africans, I've lived in some of those areas where there's no running water. There, people have to walk far to get the water. They are, in total squalor. I mean, even driving by some of those areas, you can smell it from far away, right? And I'd never seen that, and don't know of any places like that in South Africa where white people are that poor. Now, here's the issue, is that, you know, an oppressor group, right? Any oppressor group who suddenly, let's say, has to compete with the oppressed group is going to feel that somehow they've lost something, right? And so even if it's just a modicum of something, right? And so one of the things that happened with apartheid is now Black people can apply and get the jobs that that white people have traditionally been the only ones able to get, right? And so, but despite that, white people still hold the majority of high-paying jobs and the jobs that tell people what to do, the skilled jobs, and aren't willing to give them up, right? And so when they say they feel like there's racial discrimination against them or racism against them, it's only because they now have to be in the interview room with Black people. That's it. There's nothing.
We call that fragility here in the States.
Yes. Yes. And let me just say, these are the same people that once apartheid so-called ends in 1991 and 94, when Nelson Mandela gets elected, you know, there were these other negotiations that began to happen in 1991. They call them CODESA. And one of the things that the Black South African ANC basically did was something called and agreed upon with the white South African government was something called the sunset clauses. And basically the reason why they did that was to make the white minority feel okay about Black people being able to be in the government. And so what it meant was tangible. It meant that they weren't taking the land away, right? Not anytime soon anyway, even though the Constitution says it can be done. It meant that white people kept the highest positions, both in the military, police, and civil service jobs, right? And it was really there to make white people feel comfortable, right? So they're already at that point trying to make them feel comfortable. And so for 5 years, there's this transition time to just ease the fears of white people, regardless of what that did for the poor black people and how they were suffering, right? And then when they start to talk about land again, they have this program called the Willing Buyer, Willing Seller framework, right? Mm-hmm. Where they say, look, we're just asking white South African landholders to sell their land. And
would that kind of be like eminent domain in a way?
No. Yes.
I mean, you know, you come in.
Yes.
Yeah, we want to build a skyscraper, you know, in West Oakland. So we ask all the houses, we'll give you market share. I guess it's not willing because the eminent domain, they actually just will say,
yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah. Okay.
That's what I was going to say. That's the only difference is they were given the choice, right, to sell their land. And even though they had the majority of the land, they weren't giving that up. They said, no, they know how much that land is worth. So they were basically not wanting to give up the land, or that they would say that anything that was offered to them was not enough. And so for the most part, that program didn't work. So the thing is, black people over time are getting angrier and angrier because they are still working unskilled labor. They're not able to get into colleges a lot. They're not able to or to be major players in the education system. They're still in Bantu education classrooms where, you know, the education system is very apartheid. You know, Bantu classrooms were just basically black people in one classroom, and all the white people are in nice, huge schools with rolling hills and fencing. You know what I'm saying? Like that right. kind of stuff. And so people are getting angrier and angrier. And every time, what starts to happen is new political parties have popped up. The EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters, who are saying give the land back, right? And the land still not be given, being given. And then, you know, pops up here recently the new MK party, which is named after the underground military of the ANC, that's headed by former President Zuma, where they're also demanding the land to come back, right? So you've got, I mean, it's at an all-time high, the amount of anger that is happening, that that the land is not being given back to the people so that they can cooperatively use it and make sure that things are happening. Let me just say one last thing about this. It's important to understand that that when the South, when the ANC government come, you know, starts promising what they want, what they're going to give the people, which was in the Freedom Charter and that kind of stuff, they have to be able to pay for it. If you don't take the land and use it for the benefit of the people, how are you going to pay for housing in all those places where people were living in squalor? How are you going to pay for those people who don't have jobs to eat? How are you going to do all the things that you need to do for your country if you don't control the economics of your country?
We're going to jump in here and continue our interview with Professor Danea Martinez tomorrow, breaking down the history of apartheid and talking about the white Afrikaners who have been accepted here in the United States as refugees. Tune in tomorrow for another edition of Hard Knock Radio. We will continue the conversation. We are out for now. Peace.
From the waters our spirits rise. It's in the motherland ancient wisdom lies. Call and response, be your voices in the drum. Spiritual light, we remember where we're from.
It all began in Africa.
We are the children. mountains die. Guided by ancestors, we'll never die. Drums keep the rhythm, our spirits are strong. Back to our roots, where we all belong.
It all began in Africa. It all began with the drum. We are the people of the sun. It all began in Africa. It all began with the drum. We are the people of the sun.
Ancestral hands lift the veil from our sight. Chanting in rhythm, we dance in the light. No chains can hold what was never destroyed. Through ocean's river, our souls are deployed. We return to the land where our spirits were born. Where ancestors speak through rhythm and horn. Oh,
it all began in Africa. It all began with the drum. We are the people of the sun.
Our spirits are strong. Back to our roots, where we all belong.
It all began in Africa. It all began with the drum. We are the people of the sun.
We are the people of the sun.
It all began in Africa. It all began with the drum. We are the people of the sun.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
This is Bird Note. It's been raining hard for hours, but at last, the mid-April sky begins to clear. We can almost see the Gulf of Mexico from where we're standing, a quarter mile from the Texas coast, at the edge of a stand of oak trees. The rain has finally stopped, but now something else descends from the sky. Birds, hundreds, thousands of birds, rose-breasted grosbeaks, orchard orioles, painted buntings, warblers, flock after flock, they alight in trees and shrubs, sparkling indigo buntings perch alongside velvety scarlet tanagers. We are experiencing what birders call a fallout, one of the great spectacles of bird migration. The legions of birds dropping from the sky have flown nonstop across the Gulf, covering 600 miles in about 15 hours. Exhausted and hungry from bucking the storm, they land at last in tree-filled sanctuaries near the town of High Island, Texas. The birds will refuel and then fly north to breeding grounds across the continent. Isn't it lucky for the birds that people have conserved habitat for these famished and weary travelers? For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What is this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
It seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to